Richard Fry, back at the Fringe after a number of years. What would you like to ask me?
How do you do it every year? We're only 5 days in and I'm like, oh my God, another 20 days to go still.
Well, I'm going to throw that back at you in a minute because this really is an interview with you. But I was just discussing here as we're in Brew Lab about why do we keep coming each year? And we were discussing about whether can we not come? You know, do we have the ability not to come? And we were kind of owning up to the fact that there's something, I'm going to say, toxically compelling about keep coming. And you have made, I think here, uniquely, not coming is a bit of courage, a bit of a courageous decision. So before we go into why you're here this year, you made decisions not to come back, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, this is a tough decision. I have to say, in the beginning, it was largely financial, because I'd run up such a debt of being here about 5 years in a row. And then you kind of justify that to yourself, just saying how hard it is, how impossible it is. Well, I had 5 years and I had, I would say, 3 good years and then 2 not-so-good years. And when you have a good year, even though you're still losing money, because it's been fun and you've had got other work out of it, you can justify coming back. But when you had a couple of bad years, not saying the shows were bad and the audiences didn't enjoy it, but if the shows don't take off, so you don't really get anything else for coming, it's really difficult to justify coming back. And so I just remember the last time I was here 5 years ago, I remember sitting with a couple of fellow performers and saying, look, if I tell you I'm coming back next year, just tell me not to do it, because I'm telling you now that I'm not going to come back. And that happened for about 4 or 5 years, and then this year, that weird thing, like a drug addict, you just kind of have that thing inside, and it compels you back. You miss it and you just want to get back amongst it. I guess as well, you know how all of my previous shows were kind of born out of personal experience. I kind of used it all up in my previous 7 shows. So you kind of have to go away a bit to kind of get more life. So you've got something new to come and tell people about. So
then, yeah, and I guess my term, that, you know, I remember a friend of mine, Adrian Bunting, who inspired a new theatre in Brighton, an outdoor theatre, talked to me about a term, or we chatted, which is wretched contentment. And so you are critically acclaimed. You haven't had a bad show here in terms of people going, and people know you're a quality, high-quality performer. And you've mined your own life, but also the human condition, using comedy and theatre and some of the darkest aspects of growing up, all kinds of stuff like that. But wretched contentment isn't good for anyone, apart from you losing your shirt. You mustn't come back for those reasons, must you?
Well, do you know what? This is a bit of a turning point, this new show, because I used to be in quite a dark place, and it was useful to me to get on stage and tell other people how like bad my life had been at stages, and I just got a certain satisfaction in like throwing all that out to people. Fringe was also the kind of shows I do. It's kind of a thought form of therapy, and I found it useful. But because it started getting so dark as well, that I kind of thought, do you know what, I don't actually want to do this anymore. It began to feel quite negative. And so that's the kind of thing with the new show. It's kind of about turning that around. And I acknowledge in my new show that my shows used to be really dark. And the reason I've gone over to comedy is because I don't want to make people cry anymore. Do I want to try and make them laugh if I can? But there was a real, I guess, coming back, until I came back this time, there's kind of a real indulgence, I suppose. And you know, when you suffer from things like depression and anxiety, I don't know, there's a real satisfaction in wallowing in it and using it, and you get stuck in a spiral and you become a tortured artist. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's even worse. You become a tortured artist who then kind of shows it to everybody in large numbers on a stage.
Yeah. And do you know what? This is precise. I know we're not talking about my new show yet, but that's precisely exactly what my new show, because it's about Vincent van Gogh as well.
Right.
He's a tortured artist that does something quite different, but I was a tortured artist who really just pushed my darkness onto the audiences, you know. I think that was quite a lot to ask of people, because I'd market my shows to kind of be like, oh, this is a good show, and I'd get people in, and by God, there would be a twist or something, and people would walk out crying, and I would feel really good about that.
Yeah, but that's because it was good work.
Okay, thanks.
Well, apparently. Yeah.
Okay. I think you gave it a good review once, so yeah.
But I mean, that's the bit where if you come here, you know, you deserve to do that, and the audience feedback that you deserve to do it. There's an entitlement that's earned rather than assumed, because they go, hey, that was a great show. It made me cry, but I'm glad it did.
Yeah. Well, I guess that could be part of the appeal of the Fringe. It's like that's one of the few places you can get away with it. Yeah. If I went into the pub or the cafe and told my friends those stories, they would never want to hang out with me again. But for some reason, you can come to the Fringe and charge people £10 a ticket to listen to the worst things ever.
I think it happens in live poetry. I think you can do that, you know, in the poetry world and so on. So just as a bit of an update, take us to the sort of decision to write the show and what the show's about.
Okay, you know, I kind of was quite sure that I wanted to come back, and just talking about but I was quite sure I didn't want to do the old type of show, because remember they were all in verse as well, they were really intense, and it was just getting into that performance space of darkness kind of really wore me down over time. And then remember 5 years ago I came back with Pop Life, which was kind of, I came very last minute, I wasn't in the program, I just talked to Karen Corrin and there was a spare thing. I said, do you know what, I just want to come, just want to know what it's like to be on stage, tell a few funny stories, play my guitar. That was kind of like a learning curve, really, that I had to be myself on stage, and I couldn't expect the audience just to shut up and sit quietly behind the fourth wall. I kind of opened myself up to them. And that was quite a quiet show, you know, but it was fun to do. And I really learned a lot from doing that, and that kind of just lit a bit of a fire that I want to do a show somewhere in between those disciplines. So kind of like a first-person performance, like a storyteller. Not really stand-up, but somebody who could address the audience directly, but also just have a bit more meat in it than just talking about the Spice Girls and Sunita.
But also that show, the choice of venue and stuff, some part of you still had to be up there.
Yeah, definitely. When I didn't come to Edinburgh, I kind of toyed around with a couple of low-key performances at, like, the Crouch End Festival, and I did Camden Fringe actually with a new piece, and so it was always there, but Edinburgh, it's become such a behemoth and such a financial burden that actually unless you've got something you're really really sure of, I think it would be a silly decision to come back.
Because I've spoken to a few other people here about it. The actor in you still needed to be up there rather than down there with your audience. Almost cabaret style.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Storytelling
style. Yeah.
We're at the same level.
Yeah. I ran a couple of storytelling nights in London, actually, a couple of years ago. And there was something just quite freeing about not my other shows, like at the beginning, the audience come in and then we're on a ride for an hour. And there's just something more freeing, more relaxing about the show being broken up into little stories. So actually you come on and it's more like the show is like 2 minute, 3 minute, and then we all laugh and then I can move on to the next bit. And if I want to switch it up a bit, I can. I don't find it as intense. I find it scarier in some respects, but there's not
that. Bound to be, because you know you're with us. It's kind of, it's on the horizontal, not the vertical, down to the audience that are down on the horizontal.
Do you know what? The I will get more nervous before I do this show, because I actually sometimes throw things out to the audience. Say, oh, do you know who did this? Or show of hands, and how do you pronounce this? And it's kind of like, really, I'm inviting the audience in. Anybody could say anything. I'm not a stand-up. I'm not used to this kind of...
But is that capture, though? So I'm still going to get onto what the show's about in a sec. But, you know, to be or not to be, that is the question. And before moving on, Hamlet goes, so, everybody, what do you think? I'm crowdsourcing the decision.
Do you know what? It's kind of thrilling, actually. And I'm waiting for the day that somebody says something that throws me completely. But I think I need to have that, you know? It's just the best thing about Edinburgh. Do you know what? I'm quite old school, really. It's become so pressurised up here that people really feel they have to hit the ground running with a really tight, polished show. I'm more of the thing that, do you know what, I've got a good show. I know that. I know at the end of Edinburgh I will have a diamond of a show. And I just enjoy that opportunity to do it 27 times with an audience and work on it together with them, you know.
But maybe you don't need it. That's the actor again, because you could be Ken Campbell and you just do 27 shows and they are what they are.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, and, you know, so all I'm getting at is improvement becomes emergent, not something you try and plan in.
Sure, yeah, okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'm just going to get away from the life coaching for a sec. Tell us about the show.
Okay, so the new show is a deliberate move away from what I used to do, and I begin by telling people that this is my history of shows. They were very dark and about mental illness and suicide and stuff. And it's my chance to readdress the balance of making people cry. And I get up and I want to make people laugh because that's the easiest thing in the world. But in the last 5 years, I've really, when I haven't been performing or writing as much, I've really got back into art and painting. I've really, really enjoyed it. And I run an art publishing company as well when I don't perform. And I'm hopelessly in love with Vincent van Gogh, and I think he's got such a unique story, and I think there's a lot to be learned from his story. And actually, I think the story that we kind of know about him in art, myth, legend, is a bit incorrect, so I try and put it back on the right track. So I really feel really honoured to have the opportunity, actually, that I might be able just to change some people's opinions about him. I think that art history's kind of painted a slightly different man to the actual man who actually existed. And it's just about his work, really, and about how he had severe mental problems. But it doesn't really, the brutality of his mental problems doesn't really come across in his work, and that was really inspirational to me. It's kind of like, why do I want the effects of my mental illness to be present in my work? Why is that important to me? Why do I want to push that on the audience? When Vincent didn't, he kind of painted beautiful pictures. He wanted to lift people up. So that's the lesson that I take on board with this new show.
It's always, the fundamental paradox for me has been, where I've got close to thinking, if I go down that route, I will go mad. And I'm talking mental illness mad, is that if you are truly unhappy, well, are you happy in your unhappiness? If you're truly unsuccessful, have you finally succeeded in your unsuccessfulness? That actually, there's always the other side. And, you know, you can see in some people's life stories, their biographies, that they were in turmoil, but their music was the lullaby. Mm-hmm. That often is the case. It's not that the angry person created angry music, though that's happened. Now, when you go there, that paradox isn't easy to acknowledge and hold.
Do you know, I think this is a dangerous place to be. I actually talk about this in my show. I kind of briefly talk about Amy Winehouse, Kurt Cobain, Jim Morrison, and I compare them to Vincent, actually. And do you know, those people didn't exactly end up in a great place, did they? So, and I think as well, with going back to my shows, I would never do them at the time. They were always retrospective. I think it would have been really difficult to have talked about those things as I was going through them, but I found out actually I was keeping myself in those places by talking about them. But I think there is a certain indulgence. It's, you know, it's a horrible spiral to be on, isn't it?
No, but it is, but in the long view, the art of the long view is, in their, you know, horrible state, they created greatness that we still benefit from today.
Yes, absolutely.
So is there a genius sometimes hidden from us, that is the unconscious route we take because we know we're investing in the whole of humanity in some weird way?
I also talk about other artists like Goya and Hieronymus Bosch and Edvard Munch, and actually talk about how they had severe mental illnesses as well. But also, it's just the difference in Vincent. Like everything you've just spoken about, those other artists I just mentioned, is very apparent in their work. Their work is very dark. It's going, it is brilliant and it is exquisite. But the thing where I find Vincent is different and found him inspirational is how he decided to present something else to the world. And I just think at the moment in my life where I needed to kind of give up being so miserable and suicidal all the time, I've latched on to Vincent. I could easily have stayed with these other artists and been down and continued to create dark work, but do you know what, it results in a miserable existence, and I was miserable for too long. I think most of the people we've been talking about have been dead by my age. Yeah. So it's almost like discovering Vincent has saved my life, and in order to go on and enjoy the next 20 years of my life, then I have to focus on the good side, you know, rather than indulge my darkness.
Yeah, so. And I suppose it's just a part of me. I've read a lot of philosophy in my life, and I'm kind of still that paradox is, what you've been doing, I don't mean to sound disrespectful, is enjoying being miserable. Mm-hmm. And that's a bit self-indulgent.
Yeah, no, 100%. 100%. Yeah. Oh, don't get me wrong, when I used to do those shows and I used to stand on the stage and I could see people crying, oh, I felt good.
That sells tickets, maybe. So how has this been written? Is there a script? Did you go into a rehearsal room with a director, or have you been in front of a mirror?
Work with a director? I don't think I've ever.
I know, but I have to ask, don't I?
Do you know, it's just so organic, isn't it? It's not to sound like a terrible writer, artist. It comes in bits. You know, I write in my head. I make the decision. I don't write too long before I perform, so it kind of evolves. So, you know, Edinburgh, you have to commit so early, don't you? Like 6 months ago, and then even then, I'd like to go back to Edinburgh. And then before you know it, you have to give them a title of the show and then a synopsis for the programme, and you kind of think, well, I don't quite know how it's going to turn out yet. So you then have to kind of weirdly commit to something. And then you find out as you're writing it, it actually evolves away from that. Then you have to bring it back. So it's a weird process, but I keep everything in my head and I fight myself writing it down. Because I just think if the good stuff is there, my brain will hang on to it. And then eventually, I guess maybe when were my London previews were a couple of weeks before I came here. So about 3 to 4 weeks before my London previews, I would start writing it all down. And then I have about 3 hours of material. And then you have to go through it, and because there is a theme to this show. You have to be quite brutal, really. You can have some really great stuff, but then if it doesn't fit in with the show when you've got 3 hours of material, it just has to go. And so, I don't know, just forming it and then speaking it out loud. I mean, that's one of the good things about being a solo performer. You don't have to rely on other people to rehearse. You could literally do it anywhere, and you just speak it out loud and hear it. What was the question again?
You know, it's the classic theatre question. So there isn't a script. There is a theatre part of you, but this is now much more the storyteller you, isn't it?
Oh, for sure. And I think I'm in the comedy section this year, but I think if you came to see me, I'm quite obviously have a theatre background.
Yeah.
I don't have a microphone, you know. I'm not just throwing punchlines out. But I am telling funny stories, as frequently funny stories. I'm not just like telling a 10-minute Shaggy Dog story with a punchline at the end. I keep the laughs coming. But I think just because of my background, there's inevitably a bit of theatricality about me. But yeah.
Now, I haven't seen you for quite a few years, and we don't hang out in between fringes, so it's a lot of years. And as I look at you, I mean, you've still got all your teeth and they're fairly white. There's definitely a little bit more grey in the stubble. But apart from that, the T-shirt, the hair, the eyes, you're still very lost boyish, who's maybe had a bit of a growth spurt.
Lost boyish? Yeah, like a vampire?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, you've grown up a bit, have you?
Oh, do you know what? I was... last night, two friends came to see my show who I hadn't seen for 25 years, right? And we were both saying to each other, well, you haven't changed a bit, even though you think, well, I have. And then I was just saying to her, but, okay, we haven't changed a bit, but tell me, inside, do you still feel 25? And she's like, yeah, of course I do. And then we were saying, you know, when we were 25, I think like 50-year-olds looked and behaved and dressed different. I don't know, society's just became a bit more open, but it's just inside I feel exactly like I did 25 years. I mean, you must as well.
I do, but part of that, the reason I think I ask it was I had a friend, I'll never forget what he said, was he was older than me, but he's a researcher, and he used to say, I was in Moscow a couple of weeks ago, he said, and I was walking around the streets at 2 a.m. and then I suddenly realised I'm allowed to do this now, even those years. And here up at the Edinburgh Fringe, I've got memories of you had to call our mum and dad to cross the road. We're allowed to play in the street, but there were rules. And there's a bit of me that can't still quite believe that I did grow up and I'm allowed to do this. And so there you are on stage here again on your own in some ways. But there is a boyishness about you.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because you know
what? Isn't there?
Well, I was feeling old this year because I've been away for 5 years. I can notice you come year after year after year, so it probably...
Oh, thanks. But each year is new.
But not being here for 5 years, I noticed certain changes. And the thing that I really noticed this year was how young most of the other performers are. And I actually think I'm in the old man bracket now, you know. But, and I thought, I don't feel like I fit in that bracket. But
okay, well, you've now fallen into my final question.
Yeah, go on.
As we hit 20 minutes of this short interview, which was, go back to the very first Fringe up here and try and remember him. Richard Fry. And imagine that Richard Fry sits in the audience this year and comes up to you at the end of the show. What is he going to say to you?
Oh, my God, what a question. Do you know what? I think he would be so excited to see that he was still here. That, oh, do you know what? This is going to be a profound thing. I think he wouldn't believe, actually, that there's a nice, positive show that he's doing. I think he'd be really surprised that... it's over. Does that sound?
Yeah.
I think it would have done him enormous good. I'm getting emotional now. To have sat in the audience, and he would have known that the future was all right.
And is he going to recognise a lot of himself in you now?
Yeah, he probably thought he'd got a bit fatter, but.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think. Do you know what? It's all still there. In the new show, it's all still there. I reference it, but I've learnt to deal with it differently. You know, I internalised a lot of stuff. Now it's about getting all of that stuff out, but presenting it to everyone in a colourful, positive way, full of light and life, like Vincent van Gogh did.
The unbeatable heart beats on.
Oh, yeah, I love that show.
Thanks for talking to Fringe Review.
Thank you, Paul.